Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Yesterday, Saints quarterback Drew Brees did an interview with Yahoo Finance, and in that interview, Drew Brees said the following.
I will never agree with anybody disrespecting the flag of the United States of America or our country. Let me just tell you what I see or what I feel when the national anthem is played and when I look at the flag of the United States. I envision my two grandfathers who fought for this country during World War II, one in the Army and one in the Marine Corps, both risking their lives to protect our country and to try to make our country and this world a better place. So every time I stand with my hand over my heart, looking at that flag and singing the national anthem, that's what I think about. And in many cases, it brings me to tears, thinking about all that has been sacrificed, not just those in the military, but for that matter, those throughout the civil rights movements of the 60s and everyone and all that has been endured by so many people up until this point. And is everything right with our country right now? No, it's not. We still have a long way to go. But I think what you do by standing there and showing respect to the flag with your hand over your heart is it shows unity. It shows that we are all in this together. We can all do better. And that we are all part of the solution.
So that was Drew Brees yesterday. And that inspired a lot of reaction from a lot of different people. Here is Steven Jackson, a friend of George Floyd.
Shout out Michael Thomas, man. Way to hold Drew Brees accountable, Mike. I don't give a damn if he throw you all them touchdowns. Hold his ass accountable. Bad timing, Drew Brees. Bad timing, bro. All right, you play for New Orleans and you live in New Orleans. All them black people in New Orleans that support you, Drew Brees, you got to be a little bit more sensitive to the timing, bro. You can't just be saying shit out your ass. Yeah, you should understand. But y'all got to hold all y'all white teammates accountable, bro. All that shit. You know what I'm saying? We got to end that shit now. Ain't no straddling the fence, all right? Y'all got to check y'all teammates. Michael Thomas, I salute you, bro. Drew Brees. Way to check his ass. If you ain't down with us, then, hey, you on the other side. All that friend and acting like you support us, acting like you really down with us, we ain't buying that shit. All that half-ass supporting us, we ain't down with that. The same you half-ass supporting is the same you throwing them passes to that make you get all these goddamn yards. Facts. But y'all don't like the truth.
That was Steven Jackson. This is Ed Reed.
I'm going to just get straight to it. I see Drew Brees trying to do his part in keeping black folk down. You're a straight sucker for that, Drew Brees. We all got kids, so I'm going to try to mind what I say right now. Drew Brees, you're a straight sucker, man. You're a sucker for that, bro. Why you think all these young people out here protesting? Why you think they out here protesting? The looting, I can see you speaking on the looting and saying that's bad, you don't support that. But why you think all these young people out here protesting?
I really ain't got no more words for you, bro. You're a sucker, man. Straight BS, man. Straight BS. And for all my Saints fans, for all my New Orleans people who still like your ass just because they want to win games, y'all right with them. You understand? Drew Brees, you're a sucker. You're going to be a sucker. You understand? Punk, man.
Ed Reed with those comments. Now here is Malcolm Jenkins, a teammate of Drew Brees.
Drew, unfortunately, you're somebody who doesn't understand their privilege. You don't understand the potential that you have to actually be an advocate for the people that you call brothers. You don't understand the history and why people like me, people with my skin color, whose grandfather fought for this country, who served, and I still protested against the national anthem, but against what was happening in America and what the fabric of this country is for, or stands for. If you don't understand that other people experience something totally different than you, then when you talk about being the brotherhood and all this other bullshit, it's just lip service. Or it's only on the field. Because when we step off of this field and I take my helmet off and I'm a black man walking around America and I'm telling you I'm dealing with these things, I'm telling you my communities are dealing with these things, and your response to me is, don't talk about that here. This is not the place. Drew, where is the place, Drew? I'm disappointed. I'm hurt. Because while the world tells you that you're not worthy, that your life doesn't matter, the last place you want to hear from are the guys that you go to war with and that you consider to be allies and to be your friends. Even though we're teammates, I can't let this slide.
Malcolm Jenkins. I could go on because LeBron was in, so was Snoop, Saints receiver Michael Thomas, also Jamal Adams, the list goes on. This morning, Breeze posted an apology to Instagram, quote, "In an attempt to talk about respect, unity, and solidarity centered around the American flag and the national anthem, I made comments that were insensitive and completely missed the mark on the issues we are facing right now as a country. They lacked awareness and any type of compassion or empathy. Instead, those words have become divisive and hurtful and have misled people into believing that somehow I am an enemy. This could not be further from the truth and is not accurate, not an accurate reflection of my heart or my character." End quote. He went on to write, quote, "I am sick about the way my comments were perceived yesterday, but I take full responsibility and accountability. I recognize that I should do less talking and more listening. And when the black community is talking about their pain, we all need to listen. For that, I am very sorry, and I ask your forgiveness." End of quote. As far as apologies go, that one was well written, although there is some passive voice in there about, quote, "the way my comments were perceived," end quote. You can make the argument that he seems to be more interested in making it seem like he's a good guy instead of truly understanding the issues at stake. Listen, he is entitled to his opinion. I always like athletes who have an opinion and express it. But in this case, this opinion is flat out wrong. Saying that the protests had anything to do with the anthem or the flag or the military is wrong. Saying that they were disrespecting the flag is wrong, period. Breeze had this stance in 2016. He had it yesterday, twice. Once in the interview with Yahoo Finance, and he expressed a similar sentiment in a text exchange with ESPN, occasionally throwing in some all caps for emphasis. He did not misspeak. And I'm guessing that apology was a disappointment to some of his supporters and people who really wanted him to stick to his guns on this because they feel the same way. I have always enjoyed my conversations with Drew Brees. He's somebody who is very careful about what he says. If he says something a number of times over the course of years, I'm going to take him at his word that he genuinely believes it. Maybe he had a moment of clarity yesterday after so many people responded so emphatically to him. But if you just figured that out in June of 2020, where have you been for the last 4 years? Seriously, how is it possible that you still think in 2020 that Colin Kaepernick was disrespecting the flag? How many conversations and people did you have to ignore in order to hold that belief? This is a question for Breeze and for everybody else still holding on to that idea, but especially for Breeze. Like we're told time and time again that locker rooms are the ultimate melting pot. But if that's the case, after 4 years, how are you still holding on to that belief? How have you not engaged with the ideas and the realities of your teammates to the point that you recognize the simple truth about Colin Kaepernick's stance? Colin Kaepernick's protest was about racist police brutality. It was never about the flag or the anthem or the military. I don't know how many times we have to go over this, but apparently we keep having to because people keep trying to conflate the two. This is so crucial. Not only was it not about the military or the flag, but his decision to kneel was born out of a conversation with Nate Boyer, a Green Beret. It was Nate Boyer, a Green Beret, that suggested that Kaepernick take a knee. That's the degree to which he was considerate of the military and the flag during his protest. I don't know how many times I've said that on this program, and it still keeps coming up. And the issue isn't just that it's wrong to conflate Kaepernick's protest with disrespecting the flag or the military. It's ignorant. At this point, you have to wonder if it's willfully ignorant. Because trying to say that Kaepernick's protest was about the anthem or the flag or the military is an attempt to ignore it. It's an attempt to distract from it. It's an attempt to change the subject. And it's largely done by white people who don't want to engage in the hard, uncomfortable realities that Kaepernick raised. Now more than ever, we need people with the right skills to support our communities, especially the frontline workers who provide resources and care for those most in need. To help, LinkedIn is offering free job posts for healthcare and essential service organizations that need to quickly fill critical roles with the people who help us all. If you're hiring for one of these organizations, job posts on LinkedIn can help you quickly find the right people for your front line. LinkedIn can help you find frontline workers from its active community of over 675 million members. LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates for the skills and the experience that you're looking for and puts your job post in front of qualified people who meet your requirements so you can find the right person to quickly fill critical roles. To post a healthcare or essential service job for free, or if you're in another industry and you have hiring needs, visit LinkedIn.com/Rome, LinkedIn.com/Rome. Terms and conditions do apply, LinkedIn.com/ROME. We are joined by DeMario Davis. DeMario, it's nice to have you on the program today. How are you and everybody around you as it relates to the events of the last week and a half, DeMario?
Thanks for having me on. I think we're living in a climatic, you know, time in our history, you know, a lot that has gone on since our existence, and racism being in the fabric of our DNA is coming to the surface, and particularly as it pertains to the Black community. And there's a global outcry going on right now. There's millions of people in the streets protesting the treatment of Black people, not just here on American soil, but around the world. And, you know, I think it's a shame that we have to be dealing with this now, because this could have been addressed really before any of us were ever born, but it wasn't. And here we are now, and I think the most important thing is that we address it, that we deal with it. You know, so many systematic injustices, racism, all the way down to police brutality that are ultimately causing us the loss of a lot of Black lives. And we have to address that, and we have to fix that now.
DeMario Davis is joining us. Now, you've co-authored an op-ed piece with Steve Kerr, Greg Popovich, Anquan Boldin, and Andrew McCutcheon. There's a line in the piece which reads, quote, "When we watch people like George Floyd or Eric Garner get choked to death, it's hard to be filled with anything but the utmost despair," end quote. So how have you gone about not feeling that despair, or feeling it and then moving to a place of action?
That's a despair that has plagued the Black community for a long time. If you see a man on the ground that's being choked out with a police officer's knee in his neck, It wasn't a long time ago where people were publicly showing up to watch Black men be lynched and hung and, you know, be choked out in that form. And when you see that we're still connected to that history, it's like that's a problem that should have been eradicated a long time ago. And as hard as it is, we must press forward to find a solution. And I think we're living in a unique time because we have so many voices at the table, so many different ethnicities, not just the Black community and a few people from other communities, but just as many, if not more, people from different backgrounds and cultures standing beside African-Americans saying, hey, we're willing to listen. We want to know how we can help out, and we want to be a part of the solution. And that's where you see the global outcry on behalf of the Black community, which has definitely been needed for so long and definitely appreciated that it's here now.
We're talking to Saints linebacker DeMario Davis. DeMario, what was your reaction when you first heard the comments from Drew Brees yesterday?
You know, I think what was disheartening about it was that we had hoped that we would hear him elaborate more on the problem of racism, and particularly as it pertains to the black community and police brutality. I have a ton of respect for him doing an about face and saying, hey, I messed up. What I said came across as insensitive. But I am, you know, wanting to listen and know how I can use my resources to help the cause. I am on the side with the people. And that's what's most important. Now, because of how the things transpired, you know, his actions will be, we watch closely, as all of our actions should be, because it's not just saying we want to change. It's the actions that's actually going to allow us to change. And that's what we need. The black community has needed for a long time as many allies as possible. And that's why it's so great to see so many different ethnic groups who have traditionally and people who have traditionally gotten it wrong and missed the cries before, who saying, you know what, this time I'm not going to miss it. This time I'm all ears. This time I'm all in, and I want to be a part of the solution. And so it's been so many people who have missed the point initially that are coming to defense now, and that's what's most important. At the end of the day, we all have to be united in this. The community needs as many allies as possible. And that's what real change is really going to happen.
DeMario Davis is joining us. You know, there's a much bigger picture here, but just one quick follow on the team itself, because you have Malcolm Jenkins and Michael Thomas and other members of the team that were critical of those comments from Drew. Do you feel like there was damage done to the team and the locker room as a result? Does he have to work to make things right? Does he have work to do in that regard?
Well, I think, you know, All words are most importantly going to be marked by action. And one thing I know about Drew is he's a man of action more than words. But at the end of the day, it's going to be action that's required to bring about change. And you can only judge somebody based on their action, not by their first response, not by their second response, but ultimately what do they do? That's the most important thing. And all of our actions are going to be critical towards, you know, bringing about solutions. And so everybody will have to, you know, deal with their emotions individually. But at the end of the day, what matters is action and how we move forward as a country to address these issues of racism, systematic injustices, police brutality, and finding a solution, and not moving away from that topic, but working collectively to bring it into these things.
We're talking to DeMario Davis of the Saints. Now, DeMario, you've been an advocate for police reform for a while now, and as part of this conversation, you've talked about qualified immunity. For those who do not know, what is qualified immunity, and how does that play a role in all of this?
Yeah, well, it's just understanding that a lot of times officers are allowed by law to operate and be protected for their misbehavior. It's, you know, pretty much saying, you know, they're not responsible for what, you know, happens in their line of duty or while they operate. And so that's how so much mischievous behavior can go unpunished. And so, and a lot of that is in the laws, it's in the contracts that police unions have with city officials. And, you know, it's certain immunity that citizens do not have, you know. And so their rights are and privileges are higher than those that they are sworn to protect and serve. And so it's little things like that. Also, I believe in empowering the good police officers. I think there are a ton of good police officers. We need to empower them with the tools to be able to weed out the bad officers, not letting the good officers' opinions be outweighed by that of the bad officers. I think we can go a long way in helping that, which will help us clean up departments, help us with the hiring and firing process. People who have incidents before they, you know, go and kill somebody, they have incidents involving racial disputes, or, you know, they're connected to different racist organizations and whatnot. I think we do background checks and make sure we do away with the bad apples before they have something as drastic as murdering a man in front of the world.
We're talking to New Orleans Saints linebacker DeMario Davis for a few more moments. You know, when Colin Kaepernick was peacefully protesting, there were not that many white players who publicly supported him or understood the issues. What would you like to see from high-profile white players now?
I think what we're seeing, the reason why we have a global outcry right now is because so many players from both black and white and other ethnic groups have taken, you know, their platforms, the social platforms, and spoken out and encouraged, you know, their followers to do the same. I think, you know, as athletes, we have tremendous platforms. You know, you look at the pandemic, once some basketball players, you know, caught the disease and they shut it down, the rest of the world kind of followed suit. And so you realize how big that platform is. And here you have, you know, athletes who are raising awareness to what's going on in the black community that aren't necessarily a part of the black community. And that's been huge, raising that awareness, but also joining the fight, you know, being out on the front line, being in the streets, protesting and demanding change, finding ways they can get involved to go and present to legislation different ideas and solutions in the community is what's going to be most important. Action is what's most important. Everybody can say they want to be a part of the fight and they want to help with the black community, but it's going to be marked by action. That's the one thing that the black community is watching more than anything, is the action of their peers.
So tomorrow, for instance, like, obviously, advocacy is extremely important to you. Taking action is extremely important to you. So what is your reaction when you hear people say that athletes should, quote, just stick to sports?
It's always been so much bigger than sports. Humanity comes before highlights, before you ever should get caught up in your career or different accomplishments. You are a human being first, and you should always, you know, care about humanity. And you know, it's as simple as loving your neighbor. And when people are crying out, people are in pain, you know, black people being oppressed in this country, it's everyone's responsibility to hear that cry and do something to bring about solutions.
Let me finally ask you, for those who do not know your story, you write about this in The Unsuccessful Champion, finding true victory in the midst of adversity. You know, you made no secret of the fact that when you were younger, you were kind of focused on being the cool guy and doing what was cool and being a tough guy. When did you first get involved in advocacy work?
I think I had noticed it in my whole life. I didn't necessarily have any solution. But, you know, growing up in Mississippi and living in a more urban environment, and then, you know, going to school where, you know, me and my friends, we come from, you know, this poverty-stricken area, but then, you know, seeing at the same school people who live in the suburbs and just seeing that stark contrast, you know, I kind of grew up, you know, kind of knowing that there's kind of like a white side of America and a black side. You know, I went to school with it every day. And as I got older and got to college and, you know, gave my life to Christ and got discipled and, you know, started to educate myself and, you know, learn more about, you know, systems of injustice and all these different things, I always wanted to use my platform for good. You know, I was always admired people like, you know, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Tupac Shakur, people, Muhammad Ali, people who use their platform to speak out on behalf of the community. And I always wanted to do that. And when I came to the league, started my foundation, started what, you know, right away giving back to my community and trying to build bridges. And as that platform has grown, the injustices in America have become, you know, ever more prevalent. And it's been amazing to link with other players across the league and use our platforms collectively to bring about, you know, a change nationwide.
I'm looking for a particular drop right now. something that would let me know that it's time for the NBA to resume once again. Do you have anything like that under your fingertips?
Let's play some basketball!
That works. That'll work. That's what I'm talking about. The NBA's Board of Governors is voting on a plan that would represent a return to the 2019-20 season. The plan is for 22 teams to head to Disney World with the intent of restarting on July 31st. July 31st. The 22 teams would include the 16 teams that are currently in the playoff spots, and then six more teams that are within six games of the final playoff spot. That means New Orleans, Portland, San Antonio, Sacramento, Phoenix, and Washington are all going to Orlando as well, which means we will get more of Zion, more Dame, more CJ, more Aldridge, more Pop, and so on. Teams would play eight more regular season games, and then there might be a play-in tournament for the eighth seed in both conferences. If the ninth place team is within four games of the eighth place team. So that's the plan. That's the easy part. The hard part would be actually executing and pulling off that plan. Like, as hard as it was to figure out the number of teams and a format and a schedule, the really tough part is going to be daily testing, the restrictions on player movement when they're not playing. It's one thing to tell guys not to shower after games or to sit far apart when they're on the bench. But what about the other 20 hours of the day? How much of a challenge is that going to be for everybody involved? The other 20 hours of the day. And what happens if a player does test positive? Because a player is going to test positive. And what happens if that player is a key player? What if it's Giannis? What if LeBron were to test positive for the virus in the postseason? Which brings me to the other point. And that point is, we have no idea how this is going to impact all of the teams. There are probably going to be some teams who respond to the challenge and the format better than others. There are probably going to be some teams who show up in Orlando and they hit the ground running. They're red hot. They get on a roll. While some of these other teams may show up out of shape, sluggish, and then never ever do get right. There's definitely going to be a concern about conditioning and soft tissue injuries when the league does start up again. But I do want to cut off one dopey debate before it even starts. If LeBron James and the Lakers win a ring, if they win a ring this year, it is legit. It's not tainted. It's not cheapened. It's real. Don't be trying to throw an asterisk on them if it happens. They've been the best team in the West all season long. LeBron and Giannis have been the only real MVP candidates all season long. If LeBron, an MVP candidate, playing on the best team in the West all season long, wins a ring in a playoff run of a seven-game series, then it's legitimate. It's not a fluke. There is no asterisk. There is no, yeah, but it was held in Orlando during a pandemic. There's no yeah, but to it. I mean, sure, I can make an argument that having the season stopped for 4.5 months and having to play in a bubble in a theme park, I could actually argue that that might make things even more challenging than it would have been in a normal, regular season. Playing games next to a roller coaster and without a home court advantage might make it tougher, not easier. And if you overcome that, you earn what you get and you've got nothing to apologize for. The same thing goes for Giannis. If Giannis wins a title this year, there is no yeah, but about that ring. He's the reigning MVP, playing on the team with the best record in the regular season. You do that, and if you roll right through the playoffs, you are a worthy champ. So don't let Phil Jackson or any other hot take artist try to tell you otherwise.
Philip Jackson.
So at this point, in June, nearly 2 months before the season restarts, if either the Lakers or the Bucks win, there's no questioning the outcome. If either of the two best teams in the regular season win the title, they've got a legitimate claim to that crown. They've got nothing to apologize for. So you might be saying, all right, that's fine. They are the two best teams in the NBA with the two best players in the NBA. But what if somebody else freaks their way to a championship? What if somebody else flukes their way to a championship? What if there's a team that is currently a low seed and maybe not even in the playoffs? What if they show up, they get red hot, they get on a heater, and they run right through the postseason to win the title? You know, is the argument not that they're not the best team in the NBA, but they're the hottest team in the NBA? Yeah, I can make that argument about any team in any given year in any sport if they get in. If you have a team right now that's near the lower tier or on the outside looking in and they get hot and they make that run, that'd be amazing. That'd be incredible to see. That'd be brass as hell. Maybe if they get a lot of luck along the way. Maybe if there's like crazy, inexplicable luck along the way. Maybe we have that conversation. But at the same time, it would be impressive as hell to go from outside the playoffs, looking in, or as a low seed, and winning it all in a theme park. That'd be actually pretty cool. And again, not something to apologize for. I would argue that winning it all this season is actually tougher, not easier, given the way the world is right now. And that whoever wins it all has got nothing to apologize for. Until I see otherwise, that's my take. Not only is it not cheapened, but it might be one of the more impressive, intriguing wins ever. And yes, a big-time star could test positive during a playoff series and have to be quarantined for 2 weeks. Hopefully that doesn't happen. But if it does that change how the playoffs are viewed? Maybe. But then again, how would that be different than a serious injury, which happened during the postseason? Injuries are always a part of the game. Here is what we do know now. The league is giving itself a chance to finish off the season. Yes, it's going to happen in an empty arena. Yes, it's going to happen at the home of Mickey Mouse. But it's still basketball. And that's something. And it's something to look forward to. And if they can do it, now that it's allegedly set up, if they can execute it, it would be something and not something that anybody who wins has to apologize for. I'm fired up, and I know Fergie is as well.
Let's play some basketball!
Let's play some basketball.
Let's play some basketball!
He is Chris Mannix. What's up, brother? How you doing, Chris?
What's going on, Jim?
Good to talk to you. Lots going on. Listen, the NBA Board of Governors, Chris, voted to approve a plan for 22 teams to play in Orlando starting at the end of July. Let me start right there, Chris. What do you make of that plan?
The plan itself is, it can probably be described as a compromise, because in the last few weeks, there were a number of really strong-willed teams that wanted to go straight into a 16-game format. There were other teams that wanted to go all 30 to try to recoup the revenue that's going to be lost from the teams that are left out when it comes to local television markets. They have to reach a certain number of games played to fulfill their contractual obligations, and those teams wanted to do it. Here, the NBA is basically splitting the baby. It's meeting in the middle. It's giving the six teams that are within six games of the final playoff spot in each conference, five in the West, one in the East, a chance to compete for a playoff spot. There will be some form of a play-in game if the two teams in a 9 and 8 spot are within a certain number of games. Not exactly sure what that number is just yet. So it's what the NBA can do here. And you saw the vote. It was 29-1. I have no idea why Portland voted against it at this point. That really surprised me. But whatever the proposal was by the league, these owners were going to go along with regardless, because they know the importance of getting the game back off the ground quickly.
Chris Mannix is joining us. So when you look at the plan, the way it's laid out, Chris, 8 regular season games, the playoffs being played in front of empty arenas, what do you think that's going to feel like?
I can't even imagine. I mean, the closest comparison that you can make, and at least for me, is the Orlando Summer League, you know, which is now defunct, but for years it was one of the marquee summer leagues in the NBA, and they held games in Orlando at a small gym with no fans. It was just NBA scouts and general managers and team executives in attendance. And you didn't really think about it in the context of, wow, this is weird, because you're really looking at first-round picks and a bunch of guys will never play in the NBA. But it definitely was different, and you can hear everything, you know, right there on four levels. So I think it's going to be intriguing to see, you know, how teams respond when they're in a situation that many of them haven't been in since, you know, high school, maybe, if not ever.
We're talking to Chris Mannix. Chris, under the plan also, it's possible that Game 7 of the finals would take place on October 12th. First of all, what would it be like to have the finals in October, and what does that mean for the start of next season? Is it a Christmas Day start, or would it be later?
You know, I think it's great that the league is playing through the summer regardless. I've been a proponent of the NBA changing their schedule. I mean, I think there's no reason to be playing regular season games in October and November when nobody's watching. The oxygen is being sucked up by college basketball, college football, and the NFL. So I love the idea regardless. I think that the schedule itself, I'd be shocked if it started before Christmas, and I could see it being extended past Christmas. I think that Christmas Day slate, from the people I've talked to, they really want to keep that date. I mean, that's an NBA date. If people know anything about the NBA, even very little, associated with Christmas. It's like football Thanksgiving, and the NBA wants to have that audience, you know, five marquee games, and use that as a launch point of the season. But as we found, the coronavirus is going to dictate a lot of what the NBA does scheduling-wise. If we see a second wave hit the U.S. in October, November, and it's looking like it could be months before crowds are allowed back in buildings, I could see the NBA kicking the can down the road, you know, a few weeks, maybe even a month, try to maximize their potential to get fans back in the buildings. But that mid-October day, Jim, that tells you that really at the earliest you can start as Christmas.
We were talking about the NBA season. Chris Mannix is here to break it all down. You've also made the point that the layoff from March to July is similar to the layoff from the end of the finals to the start of the following season in a normal year, except players are working out throughout the summer. That has not necessarily been the case right now. So if you're an NBA team, Chris, right now, how concerned are you about the fitness of your players and the ability to get back into shape and avoid soft tissue injuries?
Oh, I think you're very concerned all the way around. And, you know, you've seen players as these facilities have opened start to matriculate in. And, you know, the coaches and GMs I've talked to about these players, you know, I haven't heard one, you know, GM say, well, this guy's in trouble or this guy's done nothing. But the problems, I think, is going to be more. Yeah, I don't think there's going to be a Sean Kemp, you know, if you go back to 99. I don't think there's going to be somebody that ballooned, you know, 40 pounds in this span. But, you know, the skills, Jim, like, you can take care of your body, you know, building a mini weight room or using a Peloton in your house. You can't sharpen the skills. And, you know, I'm in Boston, and, you know, I Jason Tatum, you know, I said recently he hadn't shot the ball in 2 months. Giannis has said something similar. So I'm very curious to see if in a span of, like, maybe a month, these guys can get their skills back to the highest level. That's why whenever I'm asked a question about, you know, which team has an advantage, which one doesn't, I don't think it's a question of veteran teams or younger teams. It's which one of these teams have the players that are the sharpest. I mean, Mike Conley has a high school level gym in his house in Columbus, Ohio. Like, he's probably doing pretty well right now. It would be good for Utah, as opposed to some of the northern teams, like in Toronto or Milwaukee or wherever, that haven't had that type of opportunity to work out. So You're not going to know anything until these guys get back into kind of full scrimmaging, you know, exactly what they all look like.
Let's not gloss over the point that you mentioned, Chris, the fact that Sean Kemp went absolute legend when he put on 35 or 40 pounds during the 1999 lockout. I mean, maybe that doesn't happen this time. What would you have given to have been there when he showed up to the facility for the first time? Maybe they had a heads up, but what do you think if you would have seen the Rain Man show up 40 pounds heavier that first day? What do you think went through their minds?
Oh, I mean, like, our hopes are dashed. It has to be. And there are two things about Sean Kemp at that point. First is, like, he was listed as going up 35 pounds. There are people in that organization that will swear it was almost double that. Like, they will swear that he was rolling in about 315 at that point. And, you know, when Wayne Embry was the GM at that time, and, you know, Wayne Embry had said, like, he went to Sean and was like, Sean, you know, what the hell happened? Like, what are you doing here weighing this much? And Kemp had said, look, I kind of rolled the dice and assumed we weren't coming back this year. And I was wrong. So here I am. So if you're the Cavaliers and you made a big trade a year earlier to get that guy, I mean, you had to think that you know, this is the kind of, you know, kind of physical setback that could turn your franchise upside down.
He rolled the dice, but he crapped out. You mentioned Wayne Embry. I can remember when I first got started, Chris, that was one of the first big-time NBA guys that I interviewed. That was a classy, classy front office type, wasn't he, Wayne Embry?
Yeah, great, and did a really nice job in a number of years with the Cavaliers. I mean, a really, you know, I didn't get to cover him. I was just getting into the league around that time, but certainly had a lot of respect for the people I've talked to who knew him over the years.
People did. Chris Mannix joining us. Chris, before you go, you've got a piece up right now on SI.com about the George Floyd protests and the role that NBA players have played in them. Overall, what do you make of the way the players have continued to be public advocates for justice?
I mean, I think it's been almost flawless how NBA players have responded. I mean, you know, from, you know, the Steven Jackson, the former player, starting, you know, kind of the momentum on this with that press conference, to Karl-Anthony Towns being at that press conference. I mean, the guy lost his mother to coronavirus weeks earlier, and he still stands up there next to Steven Jackson to support his cause. But all throughout the NBA, with players like Steph Curry and others marching and, you know, promoting peaceful protests, and Jaylen Brown driving to Atlanta and Malcolm Brogdon joining him there, I mean, these guys really have been leading by example all throughout. Look, I'm kind of writing about something like this tomorrow, but, you know, statements are great, and we've kind of become obsessed with statements. Action's so much better. And to see these guys take to the streets and be leaders in peaceful protests, especially, you know, young black men like Jaylen Brown and Malcolm Brogdon, and Dennis Smith, who was in Fayetteville, and Tobias Harris, who was in Philadelphia, to be leaders on this cause. I mean, I was blown away by how impressive NBA players were throughout this whole process.
Right, so having said all that, and you've heard what I've heard, I've been looking at the mentions and hearing it on the phones, off the air, on the whole thing. You know what I'm talking about. What is your reaction when you hear sports fans suggest the players should just stay out of things like this?
I mean, like, who should stay in it? Like, what's the – I never understood that argument. I mean, I think it was Bradley Beal that tweeted this out. Yeah, it was Bradley Beal who said, like, the perception of players that because they have – you know, 9-figure contracts and play professional basketball and have all the luxuries that come with it, that's who they are. That's not who they are. It's who they are now. It's not who they were. And, look, and I see this covering boxing even more, but it's certainly the case in basketball. I mean, most of these guys had to overcome adversity that almost none of us can relate to. I mean, I can only speak for myself, Jim, but, like, I thought I had some adversity in my life. I mean, I grew up in Boston. I got into fights a lot. I had to overcome some stuff, but it pales in comparison to the things that these guys, you know, had to go through to get to and achieve what they ultimately achieved. So I think they're more qualified than anyone to speak out on these issues. I would gladly, you know, sit down and listen to Jaylen Brown or Steven Jackson or Bradley Beal or others talk about these issues than even opine on it myself, because they are more qualified than I am, and they're more qualified than most.
Let's get international with it. Years past, this was a joint profile, because in years past, there was a Team Canada, Tag Team Canada. In 2020, that team no longer exists. That team has been disbanded. What was once Tyler in Edmonton and Matt in Vancouver. Like, who will ever forget the bros going to New York City to scout out the talent there? Who will ever forget the bros finding Ty Domi in his bar and having a cigar and a cocktail with Ty Domi? Who will ever forget the bros, Team Canada, finding Rich Ackerman and dropping a Canadian jersey on him? I mean, that was then and this is now. So what was once Tyler in Shredmonton and Matt in Vancouver is now just Matt in Vancouver.
As statistically the best Canadian caller to your show of all time, my hands are heavy and my back is strong from carrying that dirt person from Edmonton for the last 2 years. But hey, it's time to leave his ass behind like a heavy deuce and soar my sexy lean ass to new heights. Yo, Tyler, consider that a divorce.
After 3 years of being a package deal, Matt served Tyler his papers on the air back in 2019. And they have been running solo and separate ever since. So today's player profile is not on Team Canada. It's on Matt in Van. Now, it's no secret, Matt, like Tyler, has had a really rough go in the smack off. Three appearances, one top tenner. And that top 10 was as far down in the top 10 as you can get. Never a good thing when your most memorable moment in the smack off was the time that Brad and Corona put a picture of your face on the front end of his banana hammock and then broadcast it to millions worldwide on the CBS Sports Network. However, to write Matt in Van off for three disappointing smack offs would not be right. Remember, hundreds have called during the smack off. Only 14 total have won. And Matt is coming here multiple times, and he has owned his shortcomings on the big stage, in the big arena. He even referred to himself as the Clayton Kershaw of the jungle. I've got to respect that self-awareness, that self-audit. I'm sure he's broken tape on himself. He's gone to school on that. He's tried to improve on it. I'm not going to gloss over the failings in the smack off, although he does have that one top 10. I'm not going to gloss over, however, his tremendous regular season phone calls either. They happened, and they do matter. This dude has 3 years of solid, solid phone calls in the regular season. Don't believe me? Ask Keith Arnold.
Good luck to Keith, man. He's following in a long line of former crew members moving on to smaller and worse things. Will he end up like Kyle Brandt, oozing fake manufactured enthusiasm for some preseason NFL game? Will he end up like Jay Stew, picking up Rodney Pete's dry cleaning? Will he end up like Dosmati, doing whatever the hell Dosmati's doing? Or maybe he's going to end up like Austin Huff, who actually served me my coffee at Starbucks this morning. Anyway, Keith, good luck with one of the worst decisions of your life.
Besides ripping Keith apart for leaving the show and everybody else. And by the way, I think pretty much everybody else is doing pretty well. Some better than others. Only one of them is doing better than they were here. I don't know. Just kidding. Ouch. Yeah, but if I were any of those guys listening right now, I'd say, yeah, really? Really tough guy? Are you doing better since we left? Yes. Just kidding. What I'm saying, thanks, Alvy. Besides ripping Keith and pretty much everybody else who's ever left the show, Matt has taken aim at those who are still participating on the program. People like Rick in Buffalo, Lef in Laguna, Dan in Denver.
Smack off season is upon us. Time to weed out the frauds, my man. Namely, Dan in Denver, who I called out for being a cowardly punk bitch over a month ago. We still haven't heard a peep from him. I rest my case. And nice to see a cute little gif from Lef in Laguna, the Laguna Beach belly. Guess this freak's too busy swapping Q-tip techniques with Andrew Siciliano and Adam Silver to call the show. Front-running bag. And as for this gas bag Rick in Buffalo, Rick, you look like an angry, screaming human penis, man, mixing a baseball cap.
I mean, damn. The thing is, though, we know he's got that in him. And that's not just some one-off. That's not some one call that he got nice with. I know that guy's got that in him, but it's the type of game that Matt desperately needs to bring with him on June 19th for Smack Off 26. Nobody needs a good showing like that, quite like this guy. I mean, think about this. Most everybody is pulling against him. He broke off Tyler. Most of America, if not all of America, not name me, wants to see this guy go into the tank again. I mean, he is an island onto himself. He is as on his own as you can possibly be. So this is it. It's time. Matt, it's time. You know this. You're an athlete. You know this. I know you know this. I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. Put up or shut up. But I'm telling you, I would not have you in here if I didn't think you had that in you on the big stage. Like, if this guy really is Clayton Kershaw, then I'm Dave Roberts. Everybody might be begging me to pull him, but nothing's going to shake my faith in this guy. Because this is one of the guys who got us there. And I have seen the nasty, filthy stuff before.
I'm taking this Canada Heat personally, Rome. I'm a perpetual road team. I'm outmanned. I'm outgunned. but I wouldn't want it any other damn way. Rick's just the jungle's version of a mall cop, a fat loser who garners no respect at all, but his pepper spray makes him feel like a tough guy. I don't know if this Drizzle guy is good or not, but I do know Drizzle is the stupidest name I've ever heard. Ducknut, this 40-year-old loser has done nothing but record your content for 20 years and put it on his own website. It's pathetic. Your boss, Eric Spitz, female viewership has jumped no less than 900%. And hey, Mona, we're going to win you over, baby. You'll be Team Canada soon enough. War Reggie in the OC going full Reese McGuire during his call. Callan Vegas is a deluded, psychotic, hooker-addicted moron. Adam Hawk, who is such an insufferable D-bag that everyone not named Alvin has quit for far worse jobs. Mark in Boston, Tony Saragusa pimping man's depends thinks you need to clean your act up. Wartan in Denver, using a shaken up soda bottle as a bidet. And I know you've said numerous times, Mark in Boston could win a smack off. And man, you're right. If Les, Vic, Mike, Chael, Benny, Tyler, and myself all pass away before the smack off, then Mark in Boston sure as hell has a chance. Can we get Jeff a liver smoothie and go ahead and send him the hell away again? Damn, man. And his palatial estate in Virginia. I think we know that was about 10 years in a supermax federal penitentiary for sex crimes, Jeff. The only memorable thing Dan has done in the last year is get his ass knocked out by my guy, Big Daddy Beak in Studio City with a truck stop hooker bum sex blast. Hey, Rick, everybody is sick of you, and you're uglier than the new bowling ball working for Rome. The only item on our shared calendar, Corona, is Mrs. Corona's scheduled Northern Sando. Kyle, son, I'm Peyton Manning, and you're the trainer, and I'm dropping D's right on your forehead. War Canada's comeback. Peace!
You're uglier than the new bowling ball working for Rome. Wow. And to Dozmati, whatever the hell Dozmati is doing now. All right, see, this is why this guy's still invited. This is why this guy still is encouraged to show up that day. Because I know he's got that in him. That just never shows up the day of. It's time, Matty. You know this. It's October baseball now, Matty. I'm giving you the ball again, Matty. Everybody is telling me I don't know what the hell I'm doing. They're telling me I should be fired. I should not be the manager. I should no longer be the skipper because I keep running you out there every fifth day. I keep giving you the ball. Don't let me down, Matty. He is Dana White. Dana, good to have you back. How are you, Dana?
I'm great, brother. How are you?
Good, good. Good to hear your voice. Listen, before we get to Saturday's card, you and I have not had a chance to have a conversation since Justin Gaethje beat Tony Ferguson. It was an amazing performance. What did you make of what you saw from Gaethje that night?
Yeah, it was a great fight. Gaethje did what he needed to do. He fought the perfect fight and put himself in a great position. You know, when you step up and accept fights, you know, at short notice or whatever the case might be, you know, there is no reward without risk. He jumped in, he did it, and same goes for Tony. Tony took a tough fight, you know, that's how it played out.
It was an amazing fight. Dana White's joining us. So, Dana, shifting to Saturday, UFC 250. I know you're in the moment, but 250, that's a massive number. What does that milestone number represent to you?
Yeah, I mean, the sale was at 200, you know, so I've had over 50 fights since the sale. It represents that time is flying, my friend.
No, it certainly is. 250 is an enormous number, and I can't believe it's already been 50 since the sale. Now, the card, Dana, is headlined by Amanda Nunes defending her featherweight belt against Felicia Spencer. You and I have talked about Amanda in the past. She is an absolute superstar, both in the cage and just as a personality. What is it in your mind that sets her apart? What makes her so special?
Yeah, listen, first and foremost, she's the baddest woman on the planet. And if you look at the list of names that she's gone through, it's the who's who of mixed martial arts and how she beat them. Outside the octagon, she is an amazing human being. I have an incredible relationship with her. And, you know, she's doing the Tom Brady right now. She's breaking all these records that are going to be tough to break.
Is there any doubt in your mind that she is the greatest women's fighter of all time, or is that still an open question?
No, it's not a question at all. I mean, if you look at the people, she beat Shevchenko twice. She beat Ronda Rousey. She beat Jermaine de Randamie. She beat Holly Holm. And she absolutely destroyed Cyborg. So, I mean, she's the best.
I want to go back to that point, Danny. It's not just who she beat. It's how she beat them and what they say about her. Like Misha Tate said, quote, "I felt like one of those Marvel video game characters with the life bar. When you're playing the game and the life bar is trying to build, but you keep getting hit and it keeps getting smaller. That's how I felt." Kat Zingano, the last person to beat Nunes, said, quote, "I remember getting hit and seeing like the stars and birds from the cartoons." Dana, how would you describe her power and the damage it does to opponents?
Yeah, Dan Lambert, the guy who owns the American Top Team down in Florida, said that sometimes put her in there and she spars with guys and she rings their bells. I mean, this is a woman that could absolutely positively knock out a man. She is extremely powerful. She's a well-rounded mixed martial artist now, and she's the best ever.
And then coming out of the cage, she couldn't be more charming and more personable. She's awesome, but she is a killer inside. Now, Spencer was the Invicta FC featherweight champ. What is her path to a win over Nunes?
Listen, anything can happen on any given night when you get talented athletes in there together. And this woman definitely has the ability to win. And, you know, we're just sitting here talking about all the great things that Amanda has accomplished. But one of the things you can't do is think that you're unbeatable, think that you're unstoppable, think that, you know, let's not forget, Holly Holm going into the Ronda Rousey fight, nobody thought that Holly was going to win that fight. She couldn't win. This is the sport where underdogs really do upset. And you have to stay on top of your game when you are the champ. Because when you think about it, everybody is picking you apart every day. They're training just to beat you. And you have to be ready for that.
The thing I like best about your sport is everybody loses at some point. Literally everybody loses at some point because of all the various disciplines and there's so many different factors. Now, the card also features, Dana, Rafael Assunta, and that he's going up against Cody Garbrandt. It's interesting because Garbrandt was the bantamweight champ 3.5 years ago, but since then he's lost a couple of times to TJ Dillashaw. He lost in the first round at UFC 235. So where is he right now in his career after those losses?
Yeah, this is a big fight for both guys because Asunciao has been trying to get, you know, a title shot for a long time too, and Cody Garbrandt's trying to get back there. Garbrandt has dropped to number 9 in the rankings, Asunciao number 5, and, you know, this is one of those fights. You know, we have a bunch of bantamweight fights on this card for guys jockeying for position to get back in line for a title shot, so very important fight and a very fun fight. The Asunciao Garbrandt fight is a good fight.
So, Dana, what's it been like? We've had one event, but what's it been like to have the thing returned back to Nevada and doing your home base?
Yeah, no, it's been good, man. It's good to get back here. You know, we built this arena so we could do fights here. Obviously, much safer for the staff and everybody else. But I must say, Florida was very good to us, but it's good to be home.
Dana, what's it like in that smaller cage? Do you like that, and could we see more of that going forward?
Yeah, I think people are playing up too much about the smaller cage. You know, we did. I had our stats guys pull up some numbers. Finish rate is about the same between the two different cages. The problem is that in a small venue, I can't have that massive cage, and then you know. These big stadiums that we do, I can't have the smaller cage.
Right. UFC 250 is coming up. It's live from Las Vegas. It's on ESPN+. It's pay-per-view. It's coming up this weekend. Dana, of course, I can't let you go without asking you about the big dog, John Jones, and a much-discussed possible fight with Francis Ngannou. He did tweet, as you know, quote, "It's interesting to just sit here and watch your boss lie to the camera like this. We never discussed any increase in pay. Immediately, the conversation was that I already made enough. I never made a number offer." He also tweeted, quote, "I was over the situation, but I'm not going to sit back and allow Dana to lie to the fans. I never asked for an absurd amount of money. That's bull bleep," end of quote. Dana, what was your reaction when you heard all that?
Yeah, so I was in the gym working out, and I'm watching SportsCenter. And, yeah, it's fun to see that pop up, especially when it's not true. So, you know, John and I have beefed in the past. We're beefing now, and we will beef again in the future. I promise you that. You know, this stuff happens all the time. And hopefully we get this worked out. You know, I'm not trying to make John look bad or any of that stuff. Listen, the truth is the truth. And the fact that you want more money, listen, everybody wants more money. It's human nature. it always happens, you know, and it's not just John Jones. You know, we've gone through this with many fighters over the last 20 years. But, you know, it is what it is. I don't even really know what to say about it other than, you know, and then in the same text or a text right after that, he admits, yes, I'm looking for more money.
So in terms of more money, Dana, without getting into the specifics, did he drop an actual number on you?
Well, yeah. I mean, he comes out in that tweet. He says, well, since we're talking about Wilder, I'll take half of what he's asking for. I'll take $15 million.
Was that the number? Was it 15 or was it 30? Like, did he want Wilder money or did he want half of Wilder money?
He wanted Wilder money. Then when this thing went down and, you know, when it finally came out that, yeah, it was about money, he said, all right, then I'll take half. I'll take $15 million.
But he did at some point say, I want Wilder money. He wanted that full number to begin with. Is that where he started in his so-called negotiation?
100%.
Dana White's joining us. So one more thought. When a Twitter follower or a user asked him, does this mean you're giving up your title? He said yes. I mean, Dana, is that what's happening? Is he giving up his belt? Or is this some drama that's ultimately going to fade away?
I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer to that question. We'll see how this thing plays out with John. Obviously, I don't want John to give up the belt. I mean, I'm the one out here saying, you know, there's all this debate over who the GOAT is. There is no debate. There's no debate. The GOAT is absolutely John Jones. If you look at what he's done in his career, he still hasn't lost a fight. Look at all the things that he has done to himself outside of the octagon, and he still has not lost a fight. And, you know, you'll have the people that are going to say, oh, well, I don't think he won the last fight, and I don't think he won the fight before. It doesn't matter what you think. You're not a judge. The three guys that matter said he won. The guy's still never been beat, despite, the, you know, the damage he's done to himself outside of the octagon. And when I'm sitting here still saying that this guy is the GOAT, the crazy part is, imagine what John Jones could have been. And he's the GOAT. It's crazy.
Dana White's joining us. So is there a sense of what he could still be? Like, I understand you're in the middle of this right now, Dana, but, like, what would your expectation as a date and a weight class for his next fight to be?
You know, I would imagine defend the title again against Dominic Reyes. Very controversial decision, like I said, but, you know, the three judges said he won the fight. And, you know, fight Dominic Reyes again. Then you want to move up to heavyweight. You know, I respect the fight that he wants, the fact that he wants to fight Francis Ngannou, one of the scariest human beings on planet Earth right now. But I'd rather see him fight for the title.
As a non-title fight, though, Dana, you know that we're all tuning in for that. If you had to guess, how do you think that would go? Ngannou with his punching power and Jon Jones being the GOAT, in the event that that came to be, how do you think that would go?
I don't know, man. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating fight. It isn't $30 million fascinating, but it's fascinating.
Is it $15 million fascinating?
No. Hey, apparently you guys haven't been watching TV. We're in a pandemic here, right? No gates. We're fighting in front of no people. And a lot of other hurdles and things that are tough right now.
I've been seeing that myself. I have been. Dan, I don't want to make this all about him, but one final thought. Like, when you said to him, hey, John, I can show you the numbers. I can walk you through this. I can let you know. Did you say that? And did he say, I don't care about the numbers. I just know what I want.
Do you have our offices bugged or something? That is verbatim the way that went down. Come in and look at the numbers. He said, I don't care. I don't want to see the numbers. I'm just telling you what I want. That's 100%. And just for the record, all of our champions have audit rights. You can literally come in and audit. And, you know, he has all those rights to do that. He chooses not to. He doesn't care. He doesn't want to see the numbers. He doesn't care what the numbers are. He's just telling us what he wants.
I don't know, Dana. Like, I don't root, but I kind of was hoping that was going to work for him because I was going to try that myself. Yeah, I don't really care what the ratings are, what the numbers are. I mean, I just know what I want. Give me my money.
I mean, listen, go in anywhere and tell your boss you don't care about, I don't care about you guys and what's going on here. I just know what I want.
Yeah, I'm pulling for him on that one. Hey, Dana, really quickly, there's no way I can have you on the show and not ask you about Fight Island. What is the latest on the island, and are we really looking at a possible debut on June 27th?
Yeah, so we're I'll have pictures of the infrastructure next week and have more details for everybody. Yeah, this is absolutely positively happening, and I've been saying June 27th, but it's looking more like July 11th.
Okay, July 11th. That seems better. Okay.
So you have the new updated date that you know, I've been saying June. It's July 11th.
So you need more time? How come July 11th?
That's the first date that we're actually bringing in all the different guys from other parts of the world. We have a fight June 27th. It's looking like it's going to be Dan Hooker and Poirier, and we can get Hooker into the country, so we'll do it in Vegas.
Dana White making news on the way out the door. You've got UFC 250, Nunes v. Spencer. That's Saturday. That's live from Vegas. It's on ESPN Plus and pay-per-view. Look for that this weekend. Dana, great to have you back. Always appreciate you in the conversation.
Likewise, my friend. Have a great weekend.
Good night now!